This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll look at the issue of gun violence and the politics that has prevented scientists from getting good data on gun violence, gun laws, gun theft, gun suicide, pretty much any gun-related issues you can think of. But first, compare the human brain to the microchip that runs such classic games as Space Invaders and Donkey Kong, and the latter pales in comparison. You got tens of billions of neurons in the brain versus a few thousand transistors in those old games. But engineers have a complete understanding of this ancient piece of silicon, which, according to a pair of researchers at UC Berkeley and Northwestern University, makes this microchip an ideal testing ground for the methods we already use to try to study the human brain. Here to tell us more, plus other selected short subjects in science, is Ed Yong, science writer for The Atlantic, based in London, England. Hi, welcome back, Ed.
Hi, Ara.
What kind of neuroscience did these researchers perform on this microprocessor?
Well, so they did the equivalent of all the most common techniques used in neuroscience. So, for example, they would remove individual transistors, just as they would look at people who have brain damage in specific parts of the brain, or animals with lesions in parts of the brain. Or they would look at the activity of a specific transistor, just like they would measure the activity of a particular neuron. And the striking thing was that despite using these very common approaches, they learned next to nothing about the chip. And we already know how the chip works, but these approaches told them, you know, it has a clock, or it reads and writes to memory, like stuff that's so fundamental, it's incredibly trite. And it makes you wonder, like, if you can't even understand something as simple as the chip, what hope do we have of something understanding something as complex as the brain?
So they're not hopelessly down on the possibility of understanding the brain from this, are they?
No, neuroscience has taught us a lot about the brain. We know a lot about how brain activity relates to different mental states, to health and to sickness. We have drugs that work, yeah. but this is about the fundamental logic of the brain, how neural activity leads to thoughts and behavior, and we're still so far away from understanding that. But they're hoping that using the chip as a sort of testing platform will allow us to test whether theories about how the brain works are whether they're right or not. Like, if we can explain the chip, then maybe we're at least one step of the way towards understanding the brain.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the chip has a few thousand transistors, and the brain has tens of billions of neurons, so a little more complex.
Right.
to start out with.
A little bit more complex, yeah, but at least we know everything about it, so it's a good basis.
Yeah.
You know, in a situation where, in a time where people are putting so much money into big data projects of the brain, it sort of emphasizes the need for important good theory and solid experimental work.
Yeah, let's move on to some bright spots for one of my favorite things in the world, and those are the coral reefs. There's some good news about coral reefs.
There's been so much bad news.
Yeah.
The Great Barrier Reef has experienced the most epic bleaching event in recorded history. Joshua Sinner did this analysis where he, rather than looking for reefs in good or bad shape, he looked for reefs that are in much better shape than you'd expect given the circumstances. So it's not like looking for the A students in the class. It's looking for the ones who get Bs when everyone else is getting Ds. And he found that those reefs, those bright spots, contrary to what you might expect, they're not remote reefs far away from people. They're actually in areas with a lot of population growth, with people who fish and who depend very heavily on the reefs. And what they're doing differently is that they're very invested in managing the reefs. So they've got institutions and social customs in place to responsibly use the reef, and they care. You know, they're very deeply invested in it, in its resources.
So the reefs were healthier and had more fish in it when there were people present who were taking care of the reef, as opposed to those reefs that were out in the by themselves, without any population around, which is contrary to what we have thought, right?
Right. Yeah, and not necessarily in absolute terms. So they weren't pristine reefs, but they were doing better than expected. They were defying the odds in important ways, and it's important, I think, because we don't live in a world where humans can just be apart from nature. We have to manage nature with all these people on the planet, and we have to find ways of coexisting. And there are already communities and reefs out there that have succeeded at doing that, and those are the ones we need to take lessons from.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk finally about this week. We lost ecologist Bob Payne. And we actually saw Bob Payne. We talked about him with Sean B. Carroll a few weeks ago, famously throwing starfish into the ocean, that experiment that talked about them coming back. Tell us a little bit what his contributions to our understanding of ecology were.
So Bob did this famous experiment where he threw starfish into the oceans, and he saw that the beach that the starfish used to be on were just completely reshaped. So mussels took over, barnacles, and the entire community changed. And that led him to coin the concept of the keystone species, creatures that are disproportionately influential in the world around them and whose loss can ripple out through the world and cause incredible change. And this is one of the most fundamental, important concepts of ecology. And we take it for granted now, but we know about it because of Bob and his work. Mm-hmm. And the wonderfully poetic thing about this is that Bob himself was a keystone. He was disproportionately influential, and not just in terms of his ideas, but as a person, as a mentor. He trained and mentored so many scientists whose students and their students have all become key figures in ecology in their own right. So Bob created this dynasty that had sort of revolutionized the way we think about nature.
Did you ever personally get to meet him?
Yeah, I wrote a profile about him for Nature in 2012, just before his 80th birthday, and he was an absolute joy. He was so fun, so warm. He was, you know, challenging and cantankerous, yeah, but he was also deeply invested in people and very, very self-effacing. You know, the type of person that you see so rarely, and I think his impact was tremendous, and his loss will be very deeply felt.
Well, our condolences to you and all of his family in the wake of his death. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Ed Young is a science writer for The Atlantic. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Next week, as you know, citizens of the UK will vote to remain in the European Union or leave, the so-called Brexit. The debate has grown heated in weeks leading up to the vote, with arguments touching on national sovereignty, economics, immigration, and more. So why are we talking about Brexit on Science Friday? Well, 13 Nobel Prize winners, including boson hunter Peter Higgs, have warned that departing the EU would be bad for British scientific research. Stephen Hawking has gone as far as calling it a disaster. Other scientists have organized into camps, both supporting and opposing the Brexit. And Stephen Curry is a professor of structural biology at Imperial College in London. He blogs about science for The Guardian's Occam's Corner. And welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Is this a topic of Is this a topic of discussion in the UK about science?
We're not really talking about anything else at the moment, and haven't been for the last few weeks, and I think it will carry on till next Thursday as well and beyond.
Mm. So scientists, are they're divided? Are they really into two separate camps on this?
No, I don't think that's really the case. I think probably Nature did a poll. I don't know how scientific it was, but it's sort of more between 80 and 90% of scientists working in the UK are very much in the Remain camp and see the EU as a good thing. There is a minority that would favour exiting, and there is a campaign group called Scientists for Britain that is trying to put that argument. Most scientists are in favour.
Well, let's talk about that as the good thing. Why is that a good thing?
Well, I think many scientists, you know, working today recognize that, you know, science in its bones is an international activity, and that the EU is a tremendous facility for scientists collaborating together. So in the UK, certainly, we do extremely well out of the European Funding Council, which is one of the major funders of European science and facilitates lots of collaborative grants that involve scientists working together across the countries of the European Union. And it also facilitates exchange of staff between different countries, both PhD level, postdoctoral level, but also at more senior staff level. In my own department, we have several members of staff who are European nationals, but they apply for jobs in the UK on the same footing as UK citizens, and that's actually one of the secrets to the strength of UK science, is that, you know, people competing for jobs, they are competing with scientists from all over the world, and that helps to raise everybody's game. So it's seen as a major force for good in UK science by most people.
So the bad thing, I guess, is everything that you said the opposite. Why it would be bad for the UK?
Yes, that's the case. And if you look at the case that the Science for Britain is making for leaving, they're not even mounting a case that, well, if we leave the EU, UK science will suddenly leap forward. Everything will be much better. The best that they're able to argue, and the case that they're making, is that it won't hurt. And so that's the level of their argument. And actually, that is not even a very good argument, because when you look at the evidence, I think most people would agree that actually it will hurt severely the capacity of the UK to compete on the international stage.
Would that change immigration policy post Brexit? Could that affect science funding?
I think it certainly could, because who knows exactly what will happen if the UK votes to leave the European Union. If the UK wants to trade with the single market, then they will have to agree to freedom of movement, and so actually that would then mean that you have the same exchange of nationalities and people between different countries as we have now. And I imagine that if the Brexit campaign wins, a lot of their campaign is predicated on getting control of immigration, and so there are likely to be more border controls. Mm-hmm. And already I know from talking to European colleagues, both here and on the continent, they see that actually it's been a rather poisonous debate. There's an awful lot of people from Europe working in the UK at the minute feel that actually the atmosphere has changed, it has darkened somewhat, and it seems a less friendly place to come and work. And so I think already there's reputational damage that would be reinforced.
Stephen Carey, Professor of Structural Biology at Imperial College in London. After the break, we take a look at gun violence. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. From 1973 to 2012, Americans were hit by 2,000 cases of cholera, diphtheria, polio, and rabies combined. Now, as a comparison, over the same 40-year period, over 4 million firearms injuries were recorded. 4 million cases versus 2,000. And yet, here's the punchline. During that same time period, the National Institutes of Health funded 486 studies of the infectious diseases versus only 3 on firearm safety. To many researchers, that mismatch in research funding indicates that guns are not taken seriously as a public health issue. And in fact, Congress prohibits the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health from using any of their funds to, quote, advocate or promote gun control. That still leaves the door open to study the issue as long as you steer clear of advocating gun control. But the same year that the language was put in 1996, Congress slashed the CDC's budget in the exact amount of dollars they used to devote to studying firearms, meaning a de facto stifling of large, well-designed studies of gun violence. My next guest has witnessed those Washington politics firsthand. Linda DeGutis is the former director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. Today, she is chief science officer in the Aviel Foundation. She joins us from WABE in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
David Hemenway is a director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center, professor in the Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Let me ask our audience, if you're a gun owner, do you think there should be more firearm research? We're going to talk about what that would mean, what kinds of research. Just a note, we did invite the CDC to join us. They gave us a statement saying, quote, in order to pursue research into the causes and prevention of gun violence, the $10 million funding request in the 2017 president's budget would be necessary. Should these funds become available, CDC will pursue research activities that align with the priorities identified in the Institute of Medicine report priorities for research to reduce the threat of firearm-related violence. Alinda, you were at the CDC. While this language was in the appropriations bill, why didn't research continue but just avoid the policy prescriptions that were written there?
Well, I think the ban on the research and the interpretation that research couldn't be done was pretty clear. It wasn't so much that anybody was advocating for gun control or that anybody was, you know, doing research that said this is, you know, we have to take guns away from people. But in order to do some of the research and make recommendations, you know, some of the recommendations would inevitably be policy-based, much as they are with motor vehicle crashes, where, you know, we made recommendations for seat belts or for child safety seats or 0.08 blood alcohol concentrations to reduce the, you know, the number of deaths and injuries in motor vehicle crashes. The same thing would likely be true on research into gun violence, that we would find that there are probably some policy solutions that could be made. But, you know, there was a major prohibition against doing any of that. So it was extremely difficult for the CDC to even think about taking this on.
After Sandy Hook and President Obama's executive order to the CDC to study the causes of gun violence, was there any effort to start up firearms research at the CDC again? Up until now, you say that it would just be futile to try to advocate doing that.
There wasn't, and a lot of that was because at that time, all of the funding that was in the injury center and in the CDC budget that had to do with injuries was already directed and committed to other projects. So it would have meant ending other projects or ending other programs in order to take that on. And at the time that President Obama issued the executive order, he also issued a request to Congress to provide $10 million worth of funding to restart the gun violence research, and that money has never been appropriated.
David, have you sought funding from the CDC for your gun research?
In the past, yes. You have to realize CDC has been afraid to do gun research and has been really afraid to even say the word guns when you go to conferences, because if there's any research and it looks bad for it indicates that maybe having a gun in the home is not such a good thing, then often CDC gets brought in front of Congress and gets beaten up. And so I think they've just been very afraid to do gun research. The head of CDC really, even though this is such an enormous public health problem, really never even talks about gun issues, and for good reason.
Knowing how influential the NRA is in influencing members of Congress, our producer spoke with the NRA yesterday to clarify their stance on research, because they've said in the past they support more gun research. So he wanted to find out what kind of gun research that they might support. They had initially agreed to join us today, but right up at the end, they declined to come on the program, but instead gave us this statement, and I'll quote them. A major omission in the vast majority of gun-related research is the routine failure of investigators to make any attempt to incorporate or account for the positive outcomes associated with firearm ownership, especially those outcomes related to the self-defense use of firearms by private individuals. Instead, researchers will only incorporate measures of, quote, negative, unquote, outcomes, such as suicide and or homicides. This flaw in research design, which is nearly universal in the literature, results in, quote, findings, unquote, that are biased towards the conclusion sought, more gun control at the local, state, or federal levels. Linda, how do you react to that?
Well, I think that's really a fallacious argument, and it's sort of off the topic as far as the research goes. When we studied motor vehicle crashes and things that, you know, impact deaths or injuries in motor vehicle crashes, we don't study the benefits of cars or of having cars on the road. We don't even talk about that. We talk about what the risks are. So I really think that argument that, you know, we would need to say something about the benefits, it would be very hard to do any studies that would be broad enough to include all of that. So I would say someone would have to do a study just to look at the benefits and do a rigorous scientific study in order to, you know, in order to do that.
David, you've studied the issues of self-defense. Would you or could you include this, quote, self-defense element in every single study you do regarding guns?
Certainly not in every study, but I've personally conducted or sponsored over 6 surveys which have asked many, many questions about self-defense gun use. And I think that I've written more peer-reviewed journal articles, empirical articles about self-defense gun use than anybody in the world. So people in public health actually do look at the benefits and as well as the costs. And most of our studies in, often look at sort of the net benefit, the benefits and the costs combined. So if you want to try to understand, is a gun in the home beneficial in terms of reducing or increasing the risk of homicide, you end up looking at both the benefits and the costs. And if it seems to increase the risk of homicide, you've looked at it, says the problems are worse than the benefits. And if it looks like the opposite occurs, it looks like the benefits are more important than the costs. And unfortunately for the gun lobby, which is very pro-gun, most of the research, most of the scientific research indicates that having a gun in the home is not beneficial for the family, but is detrimental in terms of the health of the family.
So there's a higher risk of detrimental effect of a gun in the home than it for being used in self-defense.
Or the benefits of possibly using it self-defense, because you could use other things in self-defense, or you could do, you know, there, it's not like if you don't use a gun in self-defense, there's nothing you could do. There's people use a gun in self-defense only incredibly rarely. One of the things also I'd emphasize in terms of public health is that if we had discovered that having a gun in the home was really incredibly beneficial, I think people in public health would be really strongly promoting people to get guns. We've been saying, let's give out guns as we give out smoke detectors. We'd say, what a great thing. Let's try to arm everybody because it's so beneficial. But that's not what the science shows.
Mm-hmm. Linda, you've said that one of the things you'd like to know is what are the unintended consequences of some of our laws regarding firearms. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we know, you know, often when we study laws or look at policy, we don't look at both the intent of the policy and how successful it is at actually having that outcome. And we don't often look at the unintended consequences, what else might happen. So I think we have seen a couple of studies that have shown some very important consequences of some laws where they were really directed at trying to decrease risk, you know, perhaps crime risk, other kinds of risk of guns. But what we've seen is that there are a decreased number of suicides in the states that have stricter gun laws. Mm-hmm. So that's probably an unintended consequence, because that may not be why they were designed, but there it is.
Let me go to the phones, get a call from Mike in St. Louis. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me on. I just have a quick comment about the state of firearms research in America. I'm actually a criminologist here in St. Louis, and we do actually do a lot of research on firearms violence and the effects of gun ownership. We do it through the National Institute of Justice, which is the funding branch of the Department of Justice that funds research onto crime and the effects of things like firearm violence. So that was just my one comment, that we are doing this research, but it's just not being done through the CDC, which I think is unfortunate that it is limited only to the sociologists and criminologists and their colleagues through the NNJ.
David, thank you. David, do you know what he's talking about?
Yes. The NIJ does some funding about guns, but it's very limited in terms of the total size of the problem. What we really would like to see, given, you know, the fact that over 300 people a day on average are shot in the United States and some 90 or so die day after day, we really want to see funding, not only a little bit of funding from the NIJ, we'd like to see that increase dramatically, but we'd also like to see funding from the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health.
What don't we know that you would like to know in general about in the broad area of gun research?
There are so many things we don't know whenever you scratch the surface. I mean, one of the many things I would like to know is who is using these guns inappropriately, and how did they get these guns? We really don't know. We know so little about gun theft, about gun storage, about gun training, about gun threats, about how guns are used to intimidate or not. We don't really know nearly enough about concealed gun carrying, about liability for gun owners, insurance for gun owners, taxes on guns, or you name it. We hardly know anything.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Yeah, we hear figures all the time about these things. Is that not coming from, I guess, peer-reviewed science research, or just stuff that people are putting out there?
A lot of the stuff we get is good data, it's just says, as I just said, you know, over 90 people are dying. One of the few areas where we have incredibly good, solid research is the fact that a gun in the home really increases the risk of suicide, and increases it dramatically, maybe threefold, for everyone in the household. And that's one of the things we really, mm-hmm. really know well. Just recently, we published a study looking at unintentional firearm fatalities. And a gun advocate has been going around claiming that children are unintentionally killed by adult criminals. And that turns out not to be true at all. They're really killed by themselves or other little kids. And what we find among so many interesting things is that 2 to 4 year olds tend to shoot themselves, whereas almost all the other kids are shot by either their siblings or their friends. And where children are shot is often at someone else's house, but not until they reach the age of 10.
Let me ask Linda the last question. We're running out of time. The ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, collects data on guns. Could we use mm-hmm. that data to study some of the issues, short of getting more funding?
Sure, that data would be very helpful, but there are restrictions as far as researchers accessing that data, and those restrictions were also put in place around the same time as the funding was taken from CDC. And so the data that are there would be very helpful, but researchers can't easily access it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, David, whenever the issue comes up about gun safety or online or anywhere, there's a lot of vitriol about trying to strike down the Second Amendment and take away everybody's handguns. Is that anyone's goal in this?
I don't think so. I mean, particularly in public health, it really seems we live in a world in the United States where people have lots of guns, and so many people love their guns. And so the public health approach is really a harm reduction approach, the same way the public health approach was to motor vehicle safety. We weren't trying to take away anybody's motor vehicles. We were trying to make them safer so that there'd be fewer deaths. In the same way we're going to try to do with firearms, to make it so if we're going to have lots of guns, let's try to live with our guns. Presently, we are dying with our guns.
If the CDC continues to take a back seat on funding, can't get that $10 million at once, anybody else going to fund it?
Would be really nice to see major foundations step up, but they too have been cowed. They are afraid to go into this very controversial area. So one of the things, like I always say, is that public health is underfunded relative to medicine. Within public health, injury prevention is particularly underfunded, and within injury prevention, firearms mm-hmm. research is the most underfunded.
Linda, you get last word on that.
I would very much agree with David on that. And if we look at, you know, the kind of money that goes into other kinds of research, you know, billions of dollars are spent every year on cancer research. So even a request for $10 million to do gun violence research is pretty minimal and almost nothing when in the context of the federal budget. So I think we're way underfunded in looking at this. And if we did adequately fund the research, we could have some evidence-based solutions to the problem.
Evidence-based solutions. Wow, what a novel idea. Evidence-based. Linda Degotis is a chief science officer at the Avael Foundation, former director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. David Hemenway is a director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, it's Cephalopod Week. I know you've waited all year for this, and we have. We're going to celebrate and cogitate, and we've got a new cephalopod video. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The moment you've all been waiting for is here. That's right. Cephalopod Week is back. Today marks the start of our celebration of cephalopods. You know what they are? They are? That's right. Octopuses, not octopi, octopuses, squids, cuttlefish, and more. And to kick off Cephalopod Week, a new video about how an octopus might sense and view the world. What does the world look and feel like for an octopus? So for the rest of the hour, celebrating the octopus, its genes, its body, its mind. And if you've got a question or eight about the octopus, give us a call. Let me introduce my guest. Carrie Alberton is a graduate student in biology, University of Chicago. Worked on the first team to sequence the genome of an octopus. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Thank you.
Frank Grasso is an associate professor of psychology at Brooklyn College right here in New York. He studies octopuses in the biomimic and cognitive robotics lab at Brooklyn College. He's here with us in our studios.
Hello, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. And of course, he's the main character in a new cephalopod video produced by our own Luke Roskin. And Luke is here in our studios as well. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Good to have you all back. Carrie, you were part of a team that mapped out the genome of one species of octopus last year. And what did you discover?
Oh, we found so many things that were really pretty unexpected for us. I mean, one of the biggest things that we were surprised by was how completely normal at the level of gene families the octopus genome looked. So when we sequenced it, we kind of went through and looked for different families of genes. And when we did that, we found that they have kind of the normal number and kinds of genes that are found in other animals like snails and worms. And this was kind of particularly surprising to us because cephalopods have very big genomes. So the genome of the species of octopus that we sequenced, Octopus bimaculoides, is about 2.7 billion base pairs. Uh-huh. And that's about 90% of the size of the human genome, which is about 3.2 billion. And this is many times bigger than the genomes of other animals. So we thought that they'd actually gotten this big by making multiple copies of their genomes. And this may sound like kind of a crazy idea, but this is actually what happened along the lineage of animals that led to vertebrates like mammals and fish. So mammals and fish actually have multiple copies of their genome, multiple copies of each gene. So when we were looking through the octopus genome, we didn't actually see that signal, and we were really surprised by that.
So do you have an idea what all those extra genes, all those genes are used for?
Some of them yes, some of them no. So we found about 10% of the genes didn't have a match to anything in any other animals. So that's really exciting. And we know that there's a family of these genes that are called the reflectins, and they're involved in the coloration, the structural iridescence that's formed in the adaptive camouflage response that these animals have. And, you know, so this is just one gene family out of a whole bunch. Wow. So there's a lot to discover here. We also found that there were a couple of gene families that were massively expanded. So most of the gene families just had a single copy of the gene of the different members. But there was this one family that's called the protocadherins. And this is a group of genes that are involved in cell adhesion. And they've been studied in vertebrates where they play a role in setting up neuronal wiring. But they hadn't been really described in other animals. And so we thought we were pretty special. We've got about 60 of them. So we were really shocked when we looked in the octopus genome and found 168 of them. And near as we can tell, the last common ancestor of vertebrates and octopus only had one copy of them,
wow,
of this gene. So, you know, they had to expand them independently. I think, you know, things like that are really exciting.
Frank, I know you're excited. You've been nodding your head up and down as she spoke. You're excited.
I think this is really a wonderful set of studies, and it's opening the doors to the floodgates of a whole bunch of knowledge. We've needed this for a very, very long time. For a long time, people didn't understand where octopuses came from, and evolutionarily, in terms of their genetic composition and so forth. So many fundamental questions about these really bizarre and unusual animals in terms of their bodies and their brains will begin to be put on a solid footing with this research.
What I found interesting about learning about octopuses is that part of their brains are in their arms.
So we talk about the central nervous system of these animals because there's a distinction between the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. And to call it the brain is technically incorrect, but in terms of the computational function of the nerve cords that run through the arms, they really are acting like eight brains that are wired together to the central brain, which is the one that we would consider the cerebral ganglia.
And don't call them tentacles.
Absolutely not. They are arms. Tentacles are a really special kind of thing, which has an interesting kind of neural innovation and functional architecture that are really useful and commonly spread across the cephalopods, but octopuses didn't get one of them.
All right. Let's go to the phones to Zoe in Elk Grove, California. Hi, Zoe.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name's Zoe, and I want to know, where are octopuses' eyes?
Where are their eyes?
Well, their eyes are naturally enough on the top of their heads, right? So if you look at an octopus, you'll see a head. And the eyes have this really interesting feature, Zoe, that I think you'd like. They can actually put up little, like, whiskers by reshaping their skin to kind of reflect whether or not they're aroused. Maybe we could think about it, whether or not they're angry. Kind of like when a person raises their eyebrows.
Oh, that's a good analogy. Is that okay, Zoe? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you for
listening. Luke, you've been to Frank's lab. Must be a fun place to be in.
Well, you know, I got to be honest. It looks just like a bunch of fish tanks stacked on top of one another. But if you do look closely, you'll notice that there are special kind of rims around the edges of the tanks to make sure that the octopuses can't escape. And then, of course, the filtration systems are specially set up so that an octopus can't squeeze on through and up through and escape that way. And I also got to meet some of the octopuses there. I believe every successive year the octopuses' names go by a certain alphabetical order. So previous years was the M year. There was Mufasa and Magneto, who are in senescence, which is a stage of life that octopuses enter when they get a little older and they just want to kind of sit around and watch crab shells. And then the more new ones, Noob and Nugget, who are a lot more active and checking out their environment. Really, really always curious, and they really come up right to the front of the glass and they check you out and they want to see what you're up to.
Yeah. Carrie, have cephalopods evolved different ways to do some of the same things that vertebrates do? We're talking about those big eyes, right, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. The eyes are a classic example of convergent evolution between vertebrates and cephalopods. They're set up in terms of gross anatomy, they look very similar. It's a camera-type eye with a lens. It creates a proper image. These are some questions that we're really interested in exploring. Are there different ways of making the same structure, or are they based in more or less the same, like the same gene family setting things up?
Mm-hmm. How close evolutionary or in history have octopuses? Are the octopuses to squids? I heard they're like millions of years apart. Is that true?
Yeah. So I think current methods put them at about 270 million years diverged, right? And so to kind of put that in perspective, that's before the first dinosaur was walking the Earth. These are really old families.
Yeah. Wow. I'm stunned.
So the
right?
By that,
yeah. So they've had a lot of time to figure out how to do new and different things. And so even though we kind of group them together, and they are definitely a group, they've had a lot of time to come up with new solutions to different problems.
Looking at the fossil record, well, there are fossil records for these things. These animals diverged from our stem somewhere around 505 to 545 million years ago. And in between the time that she just mentioned and 505 million years ago, there was this plethora of species all competing and fighting their way out for a place in the sea. And probably the evolution of the brains from the primordial sort of molluscan form emerged as a result of all of these forms, the benthonites and all kinds of unusual forms that went extinct in between the ancestral cephalopod and the modern coleoid cephalopods that are the squids, the cuttlefishes, mm-hmm. and the octopuses.
Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer, Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Ira. And when I heard this was cephalopod, what is cephalopod, week?
Yes.
Or month?
Week. Whole week. A whole week.
Not a month
yet. We should have a month,
not a month yet. We're working our way up to it.
Yeah.
I said to myself, I could use another arm right now. And so because I recently broke my ankle. But anyway, and about 35 years ago, I was living on a sailboat, and we were in St. Bart's. And my friend got a spear gun out and went down to get a lobster. And while we were down there, it was just underneath his boat, like maybe 40 feet. And he looked at me. There was a baby octopus, and we looked at each other, no words spoken, of course. And he put his spear gun out, and the little baby octopus wrapped one of his, is it a tentacle?
It's an arm.
he wrapped it around the spear gun, and it was just a moment of joy. That was just, I haven't spoken to him since then, and I just know that we would both remember this, like, with vivid imagery. It was amazing. I just think they're very wonderful animals.
Nick, thanks for your call. They have a reputation for being really smart.
Right.
Are they as smart as, I mean, they're clever, right?
So let me pick up on both the thing that Luke mentioned and that caller just mentioned. There is this sense that you get when you face an octopus in a tank or in the water that it is sentient and it's participating with you. And to say that they're smart is a difficult thing. To say that they're intelligent, you need a careful definition of intelligence. But their behavior is so complex. And if we're not overly anthropomorphizing, it's true, they orient to you, they seem to attend to you visually, and they make reactions. They actually do. And there's a literature about the fact that individual cephalopods will keep track of the particular people that they have interacted with in laboratories. And when they get mad at, there are these apocryphal stories where they get mad at individuals and will squirt at them across the room as they approach because they recognize the individuals. So it's a humorous thing, and it may or may not be scientific, but I've seen these kinds of things, and it certainly goes along with the impression that the animals give when you see them.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Luke, tell us about your video. How fun was it shooting? Difficult? Did you have to go mano a mano with the octopus?
No.
Outthink
no.
it?
I've had experiences at the New York Aquarium getting hickeys from octopus suckers, but not this time. Didn't get that intimate with them. It was interesting, though, talking with Dr. Grasso about this notion of self-awareness. I've always been curious with different animals that have self-awareness, like chimps. They see themselves in a mirror. Well, do octopuses have that? Mm. But in talking with Dr. Grasso, he revealed, and we talk about in the video, that octopuses have their own kind of form of self-awareness. It may not reach their upper brain, but they have their own form of self-awareness via their suckers. They can taste themselves. So it'd be like if you licked your arm and you were like, yep, that's me. That's definitely me.
Yeah.
Or if I blindfolded you, put you in a room with other people and told you to lick other people's arms, and then somehow were able to replicate the taste of your arm, and then you licked it and went, oh, that's me. Mm-hmm. It's a little bizarre, but octopuses can do that, which is absolutely fascinating.
And this is work that that I did in collaboration with colleagues at the Hebrew University. And it makes great sense for an octopus to be able to have a chemical recognition mechanism.
Yeah.
If you have eight arms that are flopping around and have a reflex to attach to whatever they hit, no questions asked, you don't want the octopus tying itself into knots.
That's
and
interesting.
This self-recognition mechanism, or at least self-detection mechanisms, is kind of a self-defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. See if we can get a quick question in from Chuck in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead.
Hi, Ira. I love your show. Thank you for having me on Friday. Hey, what's the difference between an octopus and a squid?
Okay. Gary, okay. Do you want to talk about that?
So octopuses and their relatives have eight arms. Squid and their relatives, like cuttlefish, have eight arms plus two tentacles. So that's where the tentacles come in. And they also have inside a kind of an internal shell. In squids, it's a pen. It helps hold their body, their mantle, which is where they keep all of their stomach and their digestive organs and their hearts. It holds it out, so when they're swimming, it stays in the right orientation.
That's that. There you have it, Luke. In addition to this video with Frank, there's another cephalopod video.
Oh yeah, next
in
week
in the works.
Yeah, next week we're going to be putting up a video about deep sea squid and how they use ink. I mean, think about that. Why would a squid that lives in total darkness need ink? I mean, we think about ink as being, you know, something to escape from a predator. Well, there's other reasons, you know.
You're not going to get a hint?
Perhaps you're going to attract a mate. Perhaps you're going to repel a predator. Or perhaps, perhaps you're just going to obfuscate yourself before you strike at prey. Perhaps it's a predation technique. So that's a video that's coming next week. And then there are other videos from our partners like the American Museum of Natural History and Monterey Bay Aquarium that are coming out that are all about this kind of celebration of cephalopods. We have articles that are up on sciencefriday.com about how we have a profile of Roger Hanlon, who's been studying the camouflage of cephalopods.
Where's the octopus video? One of the most famous ones we have.
And then we have a profile of the flamboyant cuttlefish, which is basically the equivalent of a squid at a rave. It's really, really cool looking animal. We have a couple of education activities like squid prints, where you can make prints using a squid and you can look at their anatomy. We're going to have a live Facebook with squids for kids, where we're going to look at it's going to be an anatomy demonstration of squids. We're going to have a cephalopod movie night.
A
movie night.
Where?
Yes. In Brooklyn, if you live in New York City, go to sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek and check that out. And of course, we want you to join in. We want you to share your cephalies, your photos of you with your cephalopod tattoos, your art. We want you to go to cephalopodweek.tumblr.com to check out all the news that's going on with Cephalopod Week.
It's a giant cephalo party.
Yes.
So it is.
It's a celebration.
Celebration. Okay.
We squid you not.
And they will go on all week. Gary Alberton is graduate student of biology at the University of Chicago. Frank Grasso, associate professor of psychology at Brooklyn College, and our own Luke Ruskin. And you can see his videos and that stuff up on our website at sciencefriday.com and enjoy all our Cephalopod Week activities and materials at sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek. Thank you all. It's going to be a great week. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Roskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here of our production partners at the City University of New York. Go over and check out Cephalopod Week up on our website, sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek. And come join us on Monday night for our movie night here in Brooklyn. All the information up on our website. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.